Welcome back to Altered States of Context. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Chris Stouffer. Chris is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University, Physician Scientist with the VA Portland Healthcare System, and dual board certified in psychiatry and addiction medicine. He's been a sub-investigator, study physician, and study therapist at the UCSF site for Phase 2 and Phase 3 trials of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, co-investigator and study therapist for a trial of psilocybin-assisted group therapy for demoralization in long-term AIDS survivors, and principal investigator of several trials of intranasal oxytocin as an intervention for substance use disorders, including a trial of oxytocin enhanced motivational interviewing group therapy for methamphetamine using men who have sex with men. The primary reason Brian and I wanted to have Chris on today was to talk about group models in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. Chris is one of the few people with experience researching therapeutic groups with psychedelics, and that's a method that Brian and I are both really keen to learn more about and that we think is really promising as a model for psychedelic facilitation. We think you'll enjoy this conversation, and if you do, we would really appreciate if you'd take a minute and give us a review on Apple Podcasts, or they do reviews on Spotify now, or most of where you can listen to podcasts. You know, just take a minute, give us a review, and that really helps us, you know, reach more people, help people find these conversations and become more involved in the future of post-prohibition psychedelics. Thanks. Enjoy the show. Chris, hi. Thank you for coming on. As I've said before...
Hi, Brian and Nathan.
Yeah. As I've said before with guests, one of the cool things about doing a podcast is that I can, you know, learn some neat information, you know, and be like, wow, I really want to know more about this, and this person seems to be doing cool work, and it's a reason to have a conversation with them. And the occasion that I came across your name was I was really curious and looking into group work being done with psychedelics, because I think there's a lot of really beneficial things about it, both clinically, but also logistically. And so I was really curious about that. And I just started searching around and seeing who was doing work in groups. And of course, it seems like you're doing many other things, but very much including group work. And so I was talking to Brian. I was like, well, there's this guy, Chris Stouffer. I'd love to talk to him. It seems like he's doing group work. And Brian was like, oh yeah, I know Chris. It's like, well, perfect. All right. So really glad to have you on here. And I guess let's just start right there. What are you doing regarding groups right now? And then we'll just kind of take the conversation where it goes.
Yes. So I have two group protocols using MDMA. One of them is a little farther along than the other. But we're essentially, we have a MDMA assisted group therapy protocol that involves mostly group prep and mostly group integration. And then each person will have two MDMA sessions. And the first MDMA session will be individual, and it'll be preceded by individual prep and followed by individual integration. And then the second MDMA session will be conducted together in a group. And most of the group prep and integration sessions will have two co-therapists present. And for the group MDMA session, there will be four therapists present. And I guess I should say facilitators, because we're not exclusively using therapists. And I can say more about that. But we have two populations we're going to be working with. One will be veterans with PTSD at the Portland VA. And then the other study that the protocol just got approved by MAPS a couple weeks ago will be working with transgender and gender nonconforming individuals.
How did you land on that particular design of doing the individual work up front and then a group? Like, how did you guys arrive at that sort of experimental design?
Yeah, a lot of our design and protocol was informed by the work that was going on in the 70s and 80s with MDMA in groups. There were a couple different models. Claudio Naranjo was using a model where the MDMA sessions were kind of free form group. And usually those groups were conducted with people who had relationships outside of the group setting. And some groups also interacted, but it was a little bit more structured. Like people had like a talking stick that they would pass around during the MDMA sessions. And then a second kind of format for the group was used by Leo Zeff. And that was primarily people were kind of inward in their own process during the group MDMA sessions. But a lot of the requirements for these earlier group studies, and including group work with psilocybin, would require that participants have had their own individual experience first before they kind of enter into a group experience.
So with your study, what is the size of the groups? How many participants will be in each group?
It'll be group cohorts of six.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to, if you could talk a bit more about the history there, for many of our audience may not be familiar with, you know, MDMA got its start being used in clinical settings in the late 70s and early 80s. But maybe you could talk a little bit more about the way that it was used in groups, and like how do you know how much of a part of the early tradition of MDMA did groups make up?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know how much you know about the Shulgins, but you know, they were testing out these different molecules, and they were really the ones who discovered that MDMA, which was, I think, manufactured in 1912 for something completely unrelated and never got past the animal stage of drug development. But they were testing out different molecules with a small group of friends, and they really kind of noted the effects of MDMA and that it might be, you know, therapeutic. And they passed it on to their friend who was a therapist, Leo Zeff, and this was all in the Bay Area. And he started working with it and started working with other therapists and training other therapists to use it in therapy. And that's when we really learned that it was helpful for PTSD, helpful for couples work, and then some group work as well. And then MDMA started to leak out into the rave scene. And I, you know, to me, that's also group work, even though it's, you know, unsupervised, and unsupervised settings come with their own set of risks. But it's just interesting that that sort of natural progression was to use MDMA in large groups with music and movement. And then here we are today after a period of prohibition.
Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out. I tend to like to say that a lot about MDMA or psychedelic drugs generally, that they typically do in naturalistic settings often evolve to groups, which says something, right? Like it says something really important that we should listen to, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. The kind of the consistent message from, you know, whether it's MDMA or psilocybin or LSD is to me, you silly humans, you need to rebuild community, you know? And so I think for me, it's all about community. And I think I talk to a lot of people about this protocol, and a common reaction I get is, oh, that's great. That's great for scalability. That's great for time and cost effectiveness. And that's really not why I'm doing it. You know, if it's effective and we find that it's helpful, that would be a great kind of bonus. But I'm really into the unique healing potential of groups and building community.
Yeah, I mean, that is the way I think about psychedelics as well. There's such a social or connection component to these experiences. I'm wondering if you could maybe drill down a bit and talk a little bit about like what are the processes involved in from your perspective designing these studies. Like why are groups helpful, or what can you do in a group setting in terms of change in our clients and our participants in these studies that you can't maybe accomplish with more individual experiences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, I mean, to start with that, I can go back into my own history. And there was a lot of chaos in my family of origin, you know, and it was sort of the root of my own kind of personal healing journey. And I was lucky enough to find theater in high school. And I went to theater school for college. And that was really the only reason that I went to college, was to continue to pursue theater. There's a funny story. I was in a community theater production, and a friend of mine was like, I'm going to go to this university and apply and audition for a scholarship. And do you want to come with me? And it was seriously on a whim. I had to, you know, bring a song and a monologue, which I already had, and I got a scholarship to a theater program. And for me, going through a theater program with a cohort was really healing, and it healed a lot of that early family trauma. Just, I guess, learning to build trust in a group cohesion, learning to kind of work with emotions in a group setting. I think when I work in groups, you know, as a facilitator or designing these protocols, I actually draw more upon my theater background than I do upon medical school or psychiatry residency. There's just so much richness. And as a group facilitator, I mean, it's a totally different skill set than doing individual therapy. And one thing that I really like about the protocols that we're working with now, like the MAPS protocol, is we're working in small groups. We're working in groups of three. We have two facilitators and one participant. And I think so much more can happen in a group. Bowen's family systems therapy talks about the triangle being kind of the smallest unit for emotion to be processed. And so I think, yeah, it's almost like a shortcut. And then when I'm facilitating a group, my goal is to not really intervene, to really have the group interacting with each other. And once we can get to that point, you know, I think the group cohesion is at a certain level where a lot of the healing happens on its own. And I've been thinking through, I mean, internal family systems is something that's used a lot and kind of has kind of grown up alongside MDMA therapy. And there's a lot of synergy between the two of those. And I've been thinking a lot about the group, you know, system and comparing that to internal family systems. And it's interesting the different kind of parallels that you can find is people taking on different roles for the group and people being exiled from the group that you have to kind of witness and bring back into the group.
Yeah. You talk about trust, like learning to trust others, cohesion, connecting with others, the learning how to deal with our emotions around in relationship to others. I did a lot of group work at a job I had at a partial hospital program. So it was kind of a day program where, you know, patients came and spent like 6 hours a day. It was mostly group work and it was really powerful. It seemed like one of the biggest factors that was helpful to people in the program, no matter what presenting problems they showed up with, was a sense that they're not alone. They would come to the program thinking that, you know, I'm crazy or there's something wrong with me or I'm the only person who's struggling. And to be in a room full of people who, if it's safe enough to open up and be vulnerable, share like, hey, like I'm struggling with this, I'm struggling with that, can be so powerful to demonstrate that we're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you're saying, I mean, that there are several, what does he call it? It's Irvin Yalom wrote kind of the Bible of group therapy in 1970, and now it's on its sixth edition that came out, I think, in 2020. And he has 11, just he's developed this through research, pretty rigorous research, 11 gosh, I don't even remember what he calls them, like the 11 criteria of, or not criteria, the 11, I don't know, things about group therapy that are helpful. And yeah, I think what you're saying, you know, like just not being alone, it instills hope. And I think one of the most primal aspects of a group is just having emotionally corrective experiences in a group setting. It's so different than what sometimes manifests. I mean, if you're one-on-one working with someone one-on-one, the possibility that you're going to have overlapping blind spots and you can do therapy for years and years and years, and if you still have these overlapping blind spots, you're not really going to get to some of this stuff that you're kind of hiding in there.
So I'm curious as about what this looks like in practice, like a group session, you know? And so I wonder if you would mind taking us through that. You know, obviously there's administration and there's the time that it takes for the medicine to, you know, the effects to settle in. And then is there, you know, typically a period, like are people interactive, are people pretty withdrawn and kind of slowly come towards each other? Or just, I'm kind of curious, I'm sure it varies, but I'm curious about what, practically speaking, a group session of MDMA would look like.
Yeah, I think there are lots of different ways to do it. What we're going to use the Leo Zeff model, where I think he there's a quote from him about sometimes people get up and do a little hugging and then we lay them right back down on their original mats. And so I think similar to an individual MDMA session, there's ritual around the opening and the closing. And so I think those are the times that the group will be together and we can do intention sharing with the group and kind of do that initial preparation together. And then at some point everybody will be in their own space and only interacting with the therapist when needed rather than with each other. And then kind of past the peak, once we get through this session at the end, we would kind of come back together for a closing. And then of course, you know, a lot of the prep and integration would be done together as a group, but that they would really go inside, inward, that inner directed kind of focus and have their own experiences. I think even when that's the case, there's a lot of group process happening. And we know this from holotropic breathwork that's been going on for a long time. It was developed by Stan and Christina Groff after LSD was made a Schedule I substance and psychedelic research was shut down. And Stan took kind of his wisdom from doing LSD research and turned it into holotropic breathwork, which is often done together in a group setting. And that's kind of how it's done there is there's, you know, prep and integration together in a group circle, but while people are in the experience, they're in their own experience, kind of going inward rather than interacting with each other.
Is there like common music being played overall, or is it headphone people doing their own thing, or is there like a common music, or is there music at all?
Yeah, we've been talking about this a lot. So I think in a lot of settings, you know, holotropic breathwork or even like ayahuasca circles, there's music that's either played out of the speaker or, you know, hopefully some live music that everybody hears that's the same. We are going to use silent disco headphones as well that are noise canceling. So if people really don't want the music or they feel like the music is distracting, and you know, usually when people say, can you skip this song, we try to explore why they want to skip the song. And you know, I feel like 8 times out of 10 it's actually helpful to kind of continue with the song and move into the whatever is coming up for them. But if the music is distracting for someone, they can turn the music off and put the noise canceling headphones on and hopefully have a little bit more access to their internal process. And we've thought too about having a couple different channels, like having the main channel that's playing out the speaker that everybody else can hear, also in headphones, so people can have potentially a more internal experience. And then maybe having another channel with more calming music so that if the active part is happening and their process maybe is different, they can switch over to the active or turn the music off if needed. And that would all be done, you know, in collaboration with one of the facilitators.
Yeah, because I could imagine it might be kind of hard to figure it out. Right. Which button am I pushing? I don't know. How does this work again? So it sounds like at the peak of the experience, there's not, like, the social interaction is minimal. And if a person needs something or is interacting, they're going to interact with one of the facilitators or guides, or I forget what word you're choosing to use for that. But not with one another. Is that like prohibited, or is it just like encouraged to be in your own space?
I would hate to say that anything is prohibited, because I think we trust the inner healing intelligence of the individuals. But as part of our preparation, the focus will be more inner directed. The beauty of this being a pilot study is I think we're going to discover a lot of cool stuff about the protocol moving forward as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think what you're describing is fairly common of medicine ceremonies, where people are kind of doing their own work, but in, you know, with company of others. It also reminds me of some of my experiences on meditation retreats where, you know, for the time you're there, it's silent. So you actually are prohibited in this case from interacting with other people. But there's something so powerful about sitting in a room with somebody and meditating next to them, meditating next to a group of people, knowing that, you know, when it gets hard, likely everyone around me there's others around me also struggling with it and working hard. And there's something for me that's really motivating or inspirational when you get a group of people really committed to doing some hard work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then,
a quick comment on what you just said, Brian, because I thought it was so neat. Is like you said, you're not interacting with others, right? Because it's a silent retreat. But, you know, in my experience with silent retreat, it's like, yes, you can't speak with others, but there are these like nonverbal interactions that happen that you become so much more aware of, right? Like you become so much more aware of different forms of interaction and communication when you don't have words available to you, which seems like also really interesting. Sorry, go ahead, Chris. I just wanted to pick up on that because I thought that was cool thing to think about.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of what I mean about there still being group process, even though you're not really interacting. You're holding each other kind of in your minds as you go through the experience. And then if you've ever been a part of like a big holotropic breathwork workshop, people do vocalize and people are doing, you know, like body work with the facilitators or, you know, like working things out in whatever way feels right for them. And so at a certain point, it almost sounds like the sounds of a jungle, like people are making like animal noises, and that becomes part of your experience as well, in whatever way makes sense for you. We'll definitely encourage people to have their experience in the group. Just not having a conversation with each other.
Right. Which I imagine, you know, with MDMA might be tempting, right? Like I could imagine participants wanting, especially maybe even, you know, if what's coming up when they're going inside is difficult, like,
you know,
there might be an urge to talk or something. So I feel like there's so much nuance to doing a group, all these extra variables that you have to think about. I'm sure you put a lot of time into really considering different models and carefully planning, like what's the best thing to test out at this stage.
Mm-hmm. And it might be different for different populations too. And in my experience doing group therapy research, I personally think if you're doing a short kind of time limited group, it's important to have people from the same, like having shared traumatic experiences or having similar demographics, is really important because there's already that sense of cohesion. And so we did a psilocybin group study with long-term AIDS survivors. And so it was all, you know, gay men who got diagnosed with AIDS before there were medications. And so it was essentially a death sentence. So they had all experienced that trauma, similar trauma. And the sad thing about that population is, I see this in veterans sometimes as well, that they associate other people who had gone through that experience with the trauma. And so they tend to isolate rather than kind of be in community with each other. And so for that study in particular, people did not want to do, you know, we did prep and integration in the group, and then everyone had their own psilocybin session. But people at the beginning were like, why does this have to be a group? Can I, you know, I'm really triggered by other long-term survivors. And then by the end, everybody was so bonded. I know that some of the cohorts went on vacation together, and you know, they still have years later text threads, and it was a really powerful bonding experience. And so for veterans, I think there's, I kind of see this as the bookend to basic training, you know, helping them. It's like a rite of passage back to civilian life, which they don't really have in other ways. But I think they already have that mindset of kind of going into a mission, you know, having their role. And so I imagine that might be different than a group of transgender, gender nonconforming people who are, it's a marginalized community, and can be a really tight knit community. And the work that they need to do together communally as a group might be a little bit different than the veterans. And so I think we're really open to seeing how this unfolds with different populations, different samples of people. We put a lot of effort too, like, so for the veterans study, you know, we have this opportunity to have four facilitators. And to me, it doesn't make sense to have, you know, four therapists with the same training, you know, and the same background and the same lens. And so we're working with MAPS trained veteran peer support specialists. And so each group of four facilitators will include a veteran peer support specialist, which I think is really, really powerful to work with them, because they're almost like a bridge between, you know, a therapist who was not in the military and a veteran. And we have a Buddhist chaplain. She's the only Buddhist chaplain in the whole VA system. And she's a mental health integration chaplain. So she actually has a really amazing program at the Portland VA right now, where she does ACT for moral injury, and then has a program that starts to fold in family and fold in community. So by the time they finish, they're more integrated back into civilian life. And prior to the pandemic, that program involved three sweat lodge ceremonies. So she was already working with non-ordinary states of consciousness. And so we decided to partner up, and she's also going to be one of the facilitators, just to kind of have that perspective when and if, you know, people have spiritual experiences, how to help them hold that. Cause it's, I don't have the training. And so working with her, it's been a valuable experience just to see what she brings from her background and her training and her approach. And so I think, yeah, having a diversity of facilitators. And then another for the transgender gender nonconforming study, we felt like it was really important. This is going to be a two site study, one at the Portland VA and one in Salt Lake City. We felt like it was really important that at least half, if not more than half, of the facilitators were themselves transgender or gender nonconforming. And so we interviewed a bunch of therapists in Salt Lake City and in Portland, and they all got health equity scholarships from MAPS to do the MAPS training in the last cohort.
That's really awesome. I love the phrase you used. I think you said the MDMA group experience for veterans is kind of like a rite of passage back into civilian life. I love that idea of rite of passage. I mean, a lot, you know, there's this idea that this is a very common culturally found experience that's missing from our culture in a lot of places where it could be helpful. So, you know, thinking about when you said that, it sort of like made me think about the group MDMA session in a little bit different way, like not as therapy or treatment for PTSD, but, you know, kind of like, how do we help people make an adjustment of living in a certain environment, in a certain context, back into a civilian context? You know, it feels very depathologizing to me when, you know, we talk about the need for other ways of understanding psychedelic experiences beyond our medical model.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And one of the most challenging parts working on MDMA, you know, phase 2 and phase 3 trials, especially, I mean, things have changed so much just in the last, you know, year and a half. But a few years ago, when we were working on these trials, people would have these deep, profound experiences with us as facilitators. And then there was this artificial termination. And so the study had ended, the protocol was over, and people wanted to have a community that they could talk about these experiences with. Because, you know, in a lot of indigenous cultures that include psychedelics or non-ordinary states, integration is just part of everyday life, and everybody understands it in a certain way. And so it was really hard to, you know, we had some referrals for people for integration circles and, you know, outside therapists who understood the work or were MAPS trained themselves and knew how to continue thinking about integration with them. But I think it would really be helpful to just have a community for people to plug into. And I think the Oregon model with Measure 109, I think we'll start to build that here in Oregon, which is really cool.
Yeah. Being on the ground there in Oregon, which actually, you know, both of you are, and, you know, and seeing this develop, do you have any thoughts on how that's shaping up and how, you know, I'm curious, you know, as someone who's kind of watching from afar, you know, from ground zero, I guess, what are you seeing and about the process unfolding so far?
Yeah, I'm curious too. It'll be interesting to watch it unfold. I do like that they, as part of the criteria for the training programs, there's a group component. I think it's like 8 hours of group training. So it'll be interesting to see what that is. Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating to just watch something of this scale and magnitude manifest itself. You know, there are a lot of voices and it's almost like suddenly we're in the middle of the psychedelic gold rush. You know, people are coming here for different reasons and have different intentions. And I try to just kind of align with the people who I feel like have similar intentions as me and not pay too much attention to all the other stuff that's going on, because there's just so much easy to get caught up in. I don't know what your experience has been, Brian.
Yeah, very similar. I you know, I'm also curious to how this is going to actually unfold. I think there's still a lot to be worked out in terms of the details. And, you know, I'm hopeful. I know a lot of great people are working really hard to try to get this right and try to balance these different needs, like, you know, keeping the public safe and making sure that it's accessible to people. It's not too costly. So there's a lot of, you know, details that are still needing to be finalized. I do think your, you know, comparison to the gold rush, there is this, it's almost like this frenzied feeling that people are wanting to get involved, or they're very interested in it, but maybe they're not sure, you know, what's possible yet. It's still, you know, we're still at the stage where it's not an available treatment or available option for people. And that's confusing, I think, especially to clients who think that it's available now. So yeah, I'm very curious to see how this unfolds and what are the different applications that psilocybin seems to be most useful for.
Yeah. You know,
I was just going to ask, Chris, as someone who you've done work in both MDMA and psilocybin, I'd love to just hear your perspective on how you view each of these medicines and what do you see their strengths and weaknesses are. I think it's a common question people have. What's the difference between, you know, this or that? And so as someone from your perspective, what do you see as the differences?
Yeah. And I've also done some work with ketamine as well, with Polaris. And, you know, really, I think at its core, whether it's, you know, any of these medicines or whether it's meditation or sweat lodge, you can really get to the same place, right? And get to kind of the same, in touch with the same inner healing intelligence. And that's really, I feel like the process that we're working with. But as far as like the differences between working with psilocybin and working with MDMA, MDMA is much more gentle, and there's a lucidity that, you know, exists in the session that allows us to approach it in a more systematic way. And so particularly with people with PTSD or complex PTSD, you know, you can look at these resistances or look at these blocks and sit there with the facilitators and talk about it and talk about, you know, feeling safe moving into it. And you can really take your time moving into it and eventually hopefully through it. Whereas with psilocybin, we don't really have that luxury. People are just kind of thrust into whatever their experience is. And, you know, people go in with their intentions, and the experiences that I've been a part of have been wildly different. You know, like you can't say like, oh, this is a psilocybin session, this is MDMA. Like if I were watching a video and didn't know, I really wouldn't be able to tell. But I don't, you know, there have been times where, people were not even quite aware that we were in the room with them, or, you know, who we were. So it's different in that sense, but the integration piece can be very similar. And so I think, you know, with facilitated sessions, I think that's why it's so important, because a lot of the sessions that I've been a part of with psilocybin, if someone had that at a party or had that by themselves and they were, you know, naive to psychedelics prior to that, it would have just been written off as a bad trip. And that would have been that, and they probably would not have done it again, you know? And so, for us to have the integration process and to know the person and know what their intentions were and know a little bit about their history, and then to take, you know, these images or these experiences and start to pick them apart with them, it starts to make more sense to them, and they can kind of integrate those experiences into their healing journey, and it becomes part of their healing journey rather than just like a bad experience that was scary or overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm curious what might come up if individual work versus group work with MDMA or psilocybin versus group work with sober people. Just any sort of like ethical nuances or ethical questions in group work that you kind of had to consider as unique to group work with psychedelic medicine.
Yeah. I mean, there's in any group work, there's, you know, confidentiality, because you have other people in the room working with your material potentially. For me, you know, I really wanted to work in a group setting with MDMA first, although there are a couple of research sites working with psilocybin being administered together in a group. The Aquilino Cancer Center working with depression, they have, I think, 2 to 4 participants at a time being administered psilocybin, but they're in separate rooms. And they each, you know, there's like a control center, but they each have their own facilitator as well, I believe. And then at the Huntsman Cancer Center in Salt Lake City, there's a psilocybin trial with cancer patients. And I think they're also doing groups of 4, but they're within the same space. And they also have one-on-one sitters. So I think it's a little bit more, you know, there's a little bit more support and a little bit more of a framework for that work versus the MDMA. We really went back and forth a lot. You know, should we have 1-to-1 support. You know, the individual is 2-to-1 support. And so, but I think with more lucidity, more control, I'm comparing it more to a holotropic breathwork session where, you know, there's usually like a, I don't know, at least a group of 6 per facilitator. And we're going to have, you know, 4 facilitators for 6 participants. But yeah, I think a lot of people worry about, you know, like what if somebody freaks out or what if, you know, and I think we have all sorts of protocols to kind of go through, you know, if we need to get to a point where we need to remove someone to an individual space, but that's almost like the last step. I think we'll try to work with the group process as much as we can. But I feel more comfortable working with MDMA in a group in this way, at least to start out with, than I would doing groups with psilocybin.
On that note, there, the use of touch is something that is used a lot in MDMA or talked about a lot in individual MDMA therapy. It's part of the MAPS training. I'm wondering how did you need to adapt, you know, what kind of guidelines the therapist might have around touch in a group setting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we'll discover, you know, like things that we'll need to do in the protocol around this. But we, right now there's a lot of prep written into our protocol around touch, touch with facilitators as being a possibility, but then thinking also about like, what if 2 participants want to hug or, you know, like something during the session. And so there's a lot around consent. And I think one of the main things is facilitators should be working within their scope of practice. You know, if they've had training to do somatic work or some sort of training involving therapeutic touch, then they can kind of work within their scope of practice. But if it's someone who has no training in that whatsoever, you know, there should be a lot of process and discussion around even, you know, holding someone's hand. So I think we're, as a community, we're kind of exploring how therapeutic touch in the context of psychedelic sessions is going to evolve. Because it would be tragic if it went away altogether.
It seems like the MAPS recommendation, you know, in their MDMA training is sort of like a double consent, like consent to every specific type of touch whilst sober, hand holding, you know, like anything, right? Like consent, like with the facilitator sort of agreeing. And then again, whilst, you know, under the influence of the substance. So it's like, you know, both being necessary. You can't just like not talk about it before the session. And then during the session, someone says, yeah, you can like, I want, like, you need to agree before and during with the facilitators. At least that was in the MAPS training I went to. That seems to be what they are promoting. But again, it's really curious with the, you know, how that works with participants, you know, because, you know, they're not professionals, they're participants, and how they interact with each other and, mm-hmm. and how do you set up guidelines and talk about that and set that up beforehand?
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be a really different, animal, or it is, you know, psilocybin versus, MDMA. I mean, I can imagine why it would be appealing to start with MDMA. That does feel a little more like, okay, well, let's figure some stuff out here. And it's a little wilder. And at least it feels like it could be a little wilder with like psilocybin in a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how kind of the group process unfolds, you know, like synergy and how other people's experiences are affecting, you know, the other participants, like how much group process versus how much will people just want to have noise canceling headphones on, you know, go into their own process.
You know, another area, Chris, that I wanted to talk to you about, since we've got you here today, is your work in oxytocin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first question around, I'd love just to hear you talk about that work, but, more specifically, you know, I'm curious how your understanding and your work in understanding oxytocin potentially informs the way you think about why psychedelics work or why MDMA works, right? So when people ask me why does MDMA work, you know, the way I answer that is I say, well, we really don't know. We haven't really scientifically investigated the processes of change involved with these medicines. You know, initially, most of the research has been on outcomes. You know, does the depression measure change? Does the PTSD measure change? And I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface now of really scientifically investigating what's happening in these states that leads to such, you know, healing and growth. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious about how you think about that, and does your work in oxytocin inform maybe one of the ways in which you think psychedelics might be helpful?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I feel like there's a lot in there. I was just at the NIH, and NIDA had a psychedelic workshop.
Yeah, I was there too. Yep.
And I thought it was interesting. You know, day one was really focused on biological, you know, like receptors and brain circuits and things like that. And then the second day was really focused on the therapeutic process. And we have, you know, the work from Hopkins about the mystical experience. And I think one of the things that's really missing is, and a lot of people have tried to kind of work with this. I think Rosalind Watts has a psychedelic and connection measure that she's developing. But really like the social connection that happens and maybe the, you know, changes in attachment or healing of complex trauma, I think can be very, go back into those developmental attachment, dynamics. And so oxytocin is one of the primary neuropeptides involved with attachment, you know, starting before birth and then playing a really significant role in social bonding and attachment. And so that's why I was interested in that work. And primarily my work has involved working with people with substance use disorders and administering intranasal oxytocin. And I actually did a group therapy study with meth users where each group cohort, they had six sessions, and the whole group cohort would be randomized to either get oxytocin at every session or placebo at every session. And it was interesting. I wish we would have been a little bit more systematic about this, but we asked the participants whether they thought they got oxytocin or placebo, and they guessed based on chance. So there's no subjective effects to intranasal oxytocin, at least at these doses. So people can't really tell if they've gotten placebo or oxytocin, but the group facilitators guessed with 90% accuracy whether each group got oxytocin or placebo, just based on the way that the people in the group were interacting and sort of the cohesion that they felt. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And we didn't find in that study, in a lot of these studies, we didn't find any effect. I guess going back, there's a lot of animal work starting in the 70s, oxytocin for substance use disorders. And they will cannulate oxytocin directly into the nucleus accumbens of rats and mice. And there are huge effects on reduce, they'll stop pushing the lever to self-administer heroin or methamphetamine or whatever substance they're using. And then there's reduced levels of, you know, the animal model of relapse, where they'll do like stress-induced or cue-induced relapse, and animals that have been treated with oxytocin have less for that. But that hasn't really seemed to translate clearly in human research yet. And so in the group study that we did, there was no effect on methamphetamine craving, methamphetamine use. And it was like 6 week study period. And this is people who on average had used meth for a quarter of their lives. So, you know, it may not have been a long enough thing, but what we found was that people, the groups who got oxytocin, people attended, the therapy sessions significantly more.
Wow.
Than the people who got placebo. And then there was physiological changes that we could measure. So everybody had like a band measuring EKG, and we looked at heart rate variability. And attachment is so intimately tied in with physiology. And so thinking about physiology and then like approach avoidance, you know, people coming more often. It's really that's like the heart of attachment. And so I think the oxytocin piece was starting to help with attachment. And if we can get people to come to treatment more, then maybe eventually that will translate to, you know, reduced use or.
Wow. Really interesting. Yeah. That's because, and stuff like that, it is, you know, at 6 weeks, it's really limited to see if there's a huge difference, because if the main thing it does is get people to engage more, then that process, that interpersonal process of therapy, of treatment, is probably going to take a lot longer than 6 weeks. But if they're engaged, and if it could boost engagement, that's a really important thing. It just, you need to look at that. Yeah. Much, much more long-term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with, I mean, oxytocin, being in the room with someone who's been administered intranasal oxytocin versus being in the room with somebody who's been administered MDMA is very, very, very different. But I was hoping to capture some of that. I mean, actually the methamphetamine study was inspired by MDMA, because knowing that MDMA has the oxytocin piece, which is from the serotonergic piece, but also has, you know, norepinephrine, dopamine, which is the system that methamphetamine acts on. And so we were working with people who had very recently or were currently using methamphetamine in the study. So I was kind of hoping to like have the same neurochemical milieu and see if we could do some of the same therapeutic work.
So like, then what helped make that leap from oxytocin then into MDMA for you?
Yeah. And this is, I mean, I feel like whenever we start to talk about neuroscience, it's kind of all conjecture and leaves the therapeutic space. I tell people I've never thought about receptors or neural circuits while I'm in the room doing MDMA assisted psychotherapy with people. But conceptually, I think it's interesting because you have oxytocin, you know, big, huge increases in oxytocin. And there's a study, I think with mice, that shows that MDMA opens up critical, you know, developmental periods of social learning, which usually are cemented in. Same with people, like once your kind of attachment scripts are set, it's hard to change them. So we have these big influx of oxytocin. And then we also have the amphetamine part, right? We have increases in norepinephrine, dopamine, you get increases in physiology. And so to me, that's when emotional learning happens. You know, there are styles of therapy where you amp up people's physiology, hoping that they'll, you know, whatever you're doing to kind of change patterns of behavior will stick. And so having kind of that safety and that social learning with oxytocin and some of the serotonin, and then also having that sort of imprinting stimulant piece of MDMA, I think those two together are maybe how the changes can happen, how the learning can happen.
It seems like the safety, the oxytocin, that safety and connection is sort of what makes the container, you know, the way you're describing it there.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, working with methamphetamine users in this group study, you know, I think about what Carl Hart said about psychedelic exceptionalism, you know, like people who were using methamphetamine and drawn to methamphetamine, a lot of times it was the same intention. Like they were, you know, wanting to get away from trauma or get away from these uncomfortable negative experiences, which, you know, is moving toward healing. And then, you know, those drugs just do different things to the brain. And I think it's easier to kind of spin off into avoidance, and then things kind of don't go well from there. But a lot of their initial intention was to heal trauma, heal complex trauma, be able to connect with people because their, you know, their trauma had kind of cut them off from connection. And so they just were doing it without support.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point and compassionate view that, you know, gets beyond the stigma and, you know, the kind of the more traditional perception of of drug use or substance use, right? That people are trying to alleviate their suffering in some way, and they take to things because they work to the degree that they work, and until they stop working or until they create more problems. But yeah, we talk about, you know, processes of change in psychedelics. It's interesting how, to me, how they're, you know, a lot of the leading contenders, you know, having a mystical experience, neuroplasticity or the default mode network kind of going offline, inner healing intelligence, they're more individually oriented ways of understanding why psychedelics are healing. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is this very vital part of being human, which is the social domain. Mm-hmm. And maybe it would be helpful to think about, how do we maximize the therapy, or how do we maximize the container for psychedelic experiences to really enhance social learning, or to help people reconnect in ways that are going to be lasting for them beyond the psychedelic experience, like learning how to trust again, learning how to open up to people again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody's heard about the Rat Park experiments by now. That I was really inspired. I mean, those studies happened, gosh, in the 80s or maybe even the 70s. And I feel like we continually fail in our treatment approach. I mean, I think a lot of substance use treatment, especially at the VA, is very community socially oriented. But it's so easy for it to fall into that sort of, you know, this is an individual treatment for an individual, rather than creating a community healing environment. And it just makes so much sense. And there, you know, there's a lot of research that's come out just in the last like 5 years or so showing that social isolation, which is, you know, at record highs all over, and then even worsened with the pandemic, is a risk factor for all cause mortality. You know, people are dying for all sorts of reasons, and it's linked directly to loneliness and isolation.
It goes, the hyper individualism of our culture goes very, very, very mm-hmm. deep. And, you know, and just, I mean, if you look at social changes in the last 50 years too, just the community breakdown all over the place, and, you know, the rise of long commutes and both the parents and families working, and people are spread thin and disconnected more so than ever before. And I think that's context often not fully appreciated when we look at people's psychological suffering. It's like, you know, that context is really, really, really important. And we just tend to want to locate a psychological problem as a disorder inside of an individual, you know, without properly considering actual human needs, of which primarily is the need to be in community. Like, that is as deeply human as exists. I mean, we're social creatures to the bone.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, the cool thing about psychedelics is that it's, I mean, this might sound a little glib or over idealistic or something simplistic, but it's almost like a psychedelic experience is instant community, or it can be instant community, because you have this intense experience you go through with some people, and then all of a sudden now you're a group, you have something very meaningful in common. You know, I'm thinking about my own experiences on psychedelic retreats where, you know, showing up to people with people I didn't know, I'm in touch with them years later. And that's such an advantage over the just having individual therapists, because, you know, you can't have that same relationship with a therapist as you can with other people who've gone through the treatment with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I am originally from Utah. And so Utah is, you know, a state with a monoculture as far as like religion and government with Mormons. And, you know, I came out in high school. And so, you know, I was like queer in Utah in the 90s, which was not easy. And, I think I learned from that experience a lot. Like there, I saw how tight knit this community was and the benefits of that for people. And then I saw how, isolating that could be for people. And I think, you know, working in the methamphetamine study, that was kind of the, a common story, is people were exiled from their family, you know, for being gay. And then they came to San Francisco, where I did the study, thinking they would find community. And then, you know, there were all the people kind of repeating the cycles of trauma, you know, exiling them for, you know, whatever reason. And then, you know, exiling them further for being drug users. And then within the drug using community, they were exiled for being IV drug users. And it was just like went on and on and on and on and on, this echo of scapegoating. But I think, you know, there's a lot we can learn from the way that the Mormons build community and understanding, you know, who's being left out, and but not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and really understanding how healing and I mean, important for well-being community is. Yeah,
it is really interesting to think, as Brian said, like which is, you know, yeah, a bit of an oversimplification, but of course, but there's truth there, right? Like, it's kind of like this instant community. It's interesting to think about how that can happen, because, you know, it's, you know, in that experience, there's this sort of nonverbal or low verbal engagement, much lower than our normal state of consciousness. And I mean, a thought I've never thought about before in my life is what you're mentioning about oxytocin. But it's really interesting to think about, like, these ingredients for bonding. At a very, if you want to say, young developmental age, right? Like, you're kind of, there's a childlike essence to a deep psychedelic experience, you know, and that's pretty interesting to think about, that childlike state, and then encountering other people in that childlike state, and what kind of social bonding can happen in a pretty, I mean, it's like, go to the playground and watch a couple kids that haven't met each other, and they meet each other, and it's like, hey, we're best friends. This is awesome. Like, we like the same game, and we're like best friends now. It just happens so quickly. And it's like, I wonder if there's something in the group work around psychedelic that, you know, engenders those possibilities of just instantly like, hey, we're people and this is awesome. Let's be people together. Cool.
Yeah. And that makes me think of, you know, how much our society, you know, it's individualistic, but it's also we've when we move into adulthood, we forget how to play. Mm-hmm. And I think doing PTSD work, you know, doing the individual MDMA assisted therapy study for PTSD, there was a really important pivotal turning point when you could start to kind of introduce play with a participant, you know, when like a sense of humor sort of entered the milieu.
You know, that's even the case in just therapy, right? Like, just therapy is when you really get rolling, that's when you can laugh, you know, that's when things can be funny. And like, that is so important. You know, it's not all fun and games, although it is. And that's great. Right? Some, you know, some things like fun and games are super important. And when you can laugh, and of course, in a psychedelic experience, especially group psychedelic experience, when you have like this dialed up sense of the absurd. I mean, some of the funniest things I have ever experienced in my entire life were definitely in that state, where it's just like this deeply gut level hilarious. And sharing that with another person is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's been really great talking with you today, Chris. You know, one thing that kind of stands out in you sharing about your personal experiences in high school and coming out and with community is it seems like your research, your work is really informed by your personal experiences. Like, you're drawing on your own experiences and the routes that you've chosen to go in. So it's really cool to see that, and I really appreciate you sharing how your own life has impacted how you think about psychedelics and what you're choosing to spend your time on in your professional life.
Do they call that me search?
Exactly. Yes. All research is me search. It's so true. You want to get to know somebody, just look at their publication list and you'll know a little bit about their psychology. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah. Really, really fun.
You both have very nice podcast voices.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Awesome.